This is episode 194, recorded January 27th, 2014.
We're back, Aquariumaxers.
Hopefully with not to have any more interruptions in the coming weeks.
Yes, thank you for the well wishes, those of you who sent them.
And your patience.
About our health. And our patience. Your patience, yes. We were
patients. We were the patients.
Yeah. Still on antibiotics, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there we go.
At least they're working.
Mm-hmm. We're feeling better and well enough to forge ahead with an episode this week.
Yes, so on that note, we have Matt in Perth, Australia, and Bob on the south shore of Boston. And we have Mick in Carnforth, and Mike in Savannah, Georgia, and Chris in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Robert in Florida, and Tony in New York.
Indeed, quite a lineup. Mm-hmm. So let us get cracking.
Okay, well, we're going to go to Matt first, and we can review a little bit what his issue from the time before was.
And yes, he has an outdoor pond, and it was losing a lot of water, and he was asking what we thought, what the source of the water loss, because he was losing, I think, about 2.5 U.S. gallons a day. And we were thinking, well, maybe it's just evaporation from the heat, but then this is his reply.
Okay. He says, I don't think it is temperature that is causing the problem. On Saturday, the temperature reached 111 degrees Fahrenheit, and today the temperature max is 77 degrees Fahrenheit. That's quite a range.
Mm-hmm.
Is that normal?
Oh, I don't know. I don't live in Perth, Western Australia.
I know, but do they usually vary 30 degrees in a couple of, I guess Utah does. Yeah. The water loss was similar on both days. I think it might be the sea breeze. We live 5 minutes drive from the ocean, and the splashing. Still, 2.4 U.S. gallons is a lot of water to lose each day to splashing and evaporation. We are at a standstill on that, as the agitated surface water prevents mosquitoes from landing and laying their larvae. Think of trying to stand up in a ball pit. Not an easy landing.
It's kind of a fun image there.
Yeah, that's a good one. The agitations also oxygenate the water for the fish and runs water into the filter. So there's no turn the filter waterfall foundation off option.
Yeah, and that is a lot of water to lose. But it seems like if there's enough wind and splashing, it could do that.
Yeah, it could. He says, speaking of which, the filter's real cool. It has a valve that allows the water to be pumped out of the filter through a different outlet, and he sent a picture of it, so you can see in the picture.
Yeah, which we'll put on the show page.
Uh-huh. Then you rotate a lever at the top, which crushes the sponges inside the filter and rotates the filter medium, so eventually all of the medium is squashed.
Isn't that cool?
I'll have to see the picture.
Okay, well,
I always have to see the picture to figure out how it works.
I'm thinking of the whole idea because gone ahead. So
you've read the whole email already.
Yeah, I think it's cool.
So all the fish excrement is pumped out via a hose into the garden without having to get your hands dirty. That is cool.
Mm-hmm.
And it has an indicator to tell you when it is ready. And the pump we got is a dirty water pump, so it does not get blocked up by bits of plant and fish feces. And the pond has an underwater light, which I will show you on February 8th, as it will be dark over here at the time. And that, of course, is referring to the Google Hangout that we're going to do
Hangout episode, which is coming up. It's going to be next week.
A couple of weeks. Week from Saturday.
Oh, well, yeah. A week from this Saturday, so longer than 1 week. But, yeah, that'll be exciting.
That sounds like a spiffy setup.
I love the idea of this filter.
Feed your garden and have your fish, too.
Yeah, and it's made to be low maintenance, to be easy to maintain. And I love that.
We like low maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so South Shore Bob. He says, I'll be glad to send a video of the Altum breeding project. Right now it consists of a frozen hole.
A frozen hole, yes, because he's going to be breeding them outside.
Oh, okay.
And it's January in Boston, too.
So I was trying to figure out. Okay. So a frozen hole, that would be a hole in the ground. Polypropylene liner and my partner's mature Altums waiting for their summer vacation. I'll put together step-by-step video and try to keep it entertaining, or at least not too boring.
Well, I don't see how it could fail to be entertaining.
No. Yeah. The insulation will be installed in March. The ground in New England is a constant 50 degrees. Really? That's kind of cool.
Yeah. It varies somewhat from place to place, but you go down a few feet and temperatures tend to equalize all over the planet.
I guess that's true, huh?
Mm-hmm.
It's just frozen up near the top. Water, sponge filters, UV equipment, and plants will follow in April. Heaters go in May 15th, right before the fish. I love that you have the date for that. It's like a wedding day. Like, well, I've got this planned months in advance.
It's like here, you know, when we know when to plant the garden. That's about the time we can start planting gardens. It's just similar.
I just didn't know heaters had, you know, don't use before the last frost of the year dates.
Oh, I think he's probably just thinking kind of along those same lines that even a heater can only do so much against a frost.
Yeah, that's true. I'll be observing the fish every day, testing the water, and keeping a log. It would be a shame if we succeeded and had no record to show for it. That's very true.
Yeah, the documentation will be valuable to people who want to try a similar project.
Altums are to fish breeders as Afghanistan is to empires. But I think being outdoors will do the trick. Fish look and act differently outdoors. Colors pop and wild behavior replaces the aquarium prisoner routine. They'll need room. Jim Carmark suggests at least 400 gallons. So enlarge the hole to about 1,000 gallons and feed them a diet of baby fish, daphnia, insect larvae, and worms, which are all available during the summer months. I've not had predator problems, but I'll cover the pond with a net just in case.
Good idea.
Yep. So that'll be exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, looking forward to that.
Seeing the video and hearing about your observations and things.
Yeah.
Alrighty, now we're going to go to Mick.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, very interesting recent shows with the unheated aquarium theme. I was wondering what general temperature you would class as room temperature over there. The fish I sell at work are all good at 15 degrees Celsius or above, but the Corydoras and Tetras mentioned last show I wouldn't want to keep less than 22 degrees Celsius for any extended period. For me, I class unheated or temperate aquaria as 15 to 20 degrees Celsius, which is about 59 to 68 degrees Fahrenheit.
And I would say that in the U.S., room temperature is probably a bit warmer in the low to mid-70s Fahrenheit.
So
about 21 to 24 Celsius,
mm-hmm.
probably. Would you agree?
I'd say when people say room temperature, that's usually about what I think of, yeah.
Okay, that's what I would think of. If I think of any climate-controlled, like, residential building or whatever, that's where it usually is, somewhere in there.
That's where it should be. It usually feels like, though, if they have the air conditioning on, that they have it on at, like, 65, and it's freezing.
Well, our house, we set the temperature at 70.
I think that's what room temperature usually refers to, is about 70 degrees. Yeah,
we set ours at 70, and during the winter, it'll go up to, you know, 72 sometimes on a warm day. And in the summer, of course, it's much warmer.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's about, I think, considered average, probably.
Yeah, I think so. He says, the paradise fish are fabulous. I have just set up a 60-liter tank with a trio of paradise.
But doesn't he say paradise fish are fab?
Well, yeah, but I assumed he was, like, abbreviating.
Oh, but I think the abbreviation is used in Britain quite a bit.
Oh, okay. Paradise just fish straight. Are fab.
There.
Brilliant. How about that? Is that good?
Okay. Don't they have, like, a show that they did in Britain years ago, and it was called Absolutely Fabulous, but people called it Ab Fab?
I don't know. Maybe that was before my time.
I don't know. Well, I had a roommate who used to watch it all okay. the time, so I don't know. Okay.
That sounds like an exercise, like a piece of ab exercise fab? Equipment.
Make your abs fabulous?
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry.
So he's got a trio of paradise fish, 10 Indian glass fish, and a ruby shark. I will try to send a video later this week. Yes, the ruby shark will need a bigger tank in the future. So I don't know what a ruby shark is. What's a ruby shark?
A lot of times over here they call them red sharks. You've seen they have several species of closely related sharks, Labio genus, red-tailed black sharks, rainbow sharks.
Are they actually a shark?
No.
Or is they call them sharks like they call bala sharks?
They're bony freshwater fish. They're not cartilaginous like shark, ray, skate kind of fish. No. Okay. But they look shark-like because they have a dorsal fin that's that shape. Their general body shape is quite similar. They have little barbels.
Little barbels.
Mm-hmm.
Barbel, barbel, barbel.
Yeah, and they can be quite aggressive when they grow up.
How big do they get?
Quite large, depending on the species. Some of the species are good, you know, a couple feet long.
Oh, okay.
But some of them aren't quite that big. But the ruby shark, I did watch the video. I can't remember think it might have been what we'd call a rainbow shark here. I'd have to look again. But those have kind of reddish fins, and then their body is a, you know, I'm colorblind here. Not red color.
A not red color.
The body. But they're, yeah, they're quite, they're pretty. Okay. Striking fish, but anyway.
And then Indian glassfish is, do we just usually call them glassfish, or is that different than
glassfish? They're very often called glassfish over here, not to be confused with glass catfish.
Okay, tell me the two different, I mean, tell me them.
Okay, glass.
That was eloquent.
Indian glassfish are a, they're shaped more like a deep-bodied tetra, not like a long, the, you know, the glass catfish are kind of long, sort of an elongated teardrop shape.
Okay.
But these are not. Indian glassfish are not like that at all. You remember the tetras we saw at the doctor's office recently?
Yes.
And they had sort of a deep body compared to like a neon tetra, which has a rather thin, you know, body.
Okay.
Anyway, they have a deep body kind of like that. And they have, if I remember correctly, two dorsal fins, kind of, you know, there's a separation between them. And then their body's quite transparent, but it often has little bits of, little kind of edges that are outlined a little bit in some color, and that can fade over time and often does. It seems like when you get them at a shop or something, they often have a little bit of that, but it tends to fade out, and so they get even more transparent. Although, unfortunately, some of them are dyed. And that's, you know, I'm sure that's not the case with the one that Mick has, but
no.
They have been seen, you know, that is something that has been done. But anyway, they're quite striking fish. I don't see them a lot, though. And you don't see them in Mick's video either.
Oh, because they're...
Well, they're also quite timid, as he mentions.
Okay, well, I'll have to see the video, because...
Yeah, I'll have to show you the video.
Okay. He says, I was wondering how the gold barbs are doing with the paradise fish in your tank. Any signs of fin nipping?
No, really. No, I was a bit worried about that, and it's a good thing you bring it up. I mean, it's something to think about, because I know that... paradise fish can get a bit territorial, and even...
Well, he has chased them.
Oh, he chases them a little bit, but not seriously.
Mm-hmm.
It's not anything that has resulted in any damage so far. It's, of course, as you mentioned, something to look for, and so I may have to make some modifications to the setup eventually. But for now, it looks like he is keeping them on their toes just a little, enough to make them kind of school together a little bit more, which is nice. And they seem happy as clams. I mean, they seem to be spawning every other...
Yeah.
You know, every time I change the water, every time the light turns on, they're spawning. So, kind of cool. Yeah, so everybody... Not that a little bit of stress wouldn't cause them necessarily not to spawn, but it's usually a good sign if they're spawning that they're not in too bad a situation.
Mm-hmm.
But I will keep my eye on that because it's something just to do.
We're enjoying actually seeing something in the tank.
Yeah, I moved the catfish to a small tank at work in hopes that they will be happier and more visible and spawn in there and not be eaten. The babies won't be eaten, or eggs,
right,
whatever.
Okay, and Mick says, and now...
Axolotl news!
The fry are growing on well and feeding on microworms twice a day. The adults were out in a small shaded pond during the summer and brought into the house in mid-October.
Now, we asked about temperatures, because remember we were talking about how they need fairly cool temperatures?
Oh, right, and we didn't know if we could keep them in the house.
Right.
Oh, excuse me. Sorry, so guys. Says, long day. He says, so they were out in a shaded pond during the summer and brought into the house in mid-October. The water temperature was 18 degrees Celsius, which translates to about 64 degrees Fahrenheit. In the house, and now they're back in the fish room in a cool corner at about 17 degrees Celsius or 63 degrees Fahrenheit.
Okay, so that makes sense. That's consistent with what we had researched.
That's too cold for me.
Right, but
we'd have to have a chiller.
We'd have to have a chiller of some kind, which is fine, you know. Well, that may be something we look into doing in the future. There are do-it-yourself chillers that are not nearly as expensive as the other ones. But yeah. Now, in a shaded pond where Mick is, it sounds like it worked just fine for him. In a shaded pond here, it'd probably get too hot. But it depends. I mean, there are things you can do with ponds to help them be cooler, too.
Well, I think our climate in general is just more extreme.
Right. Although he said that heat wave he had that one time was really crazy.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was like over 100 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
It's like 104 or something. So, There you go.
And he says, I should still be okay for the 8th of February. Let me know when I need to do it in advance. So let's just say one more time what everybody needs to do if they want to get in the Google Hangout.
I think we've got, in terms of people who will be on the show as, you know, videoed guests and participating fully with a camera, audio visual stuff, we've got everybody who's going to do that. And that does include Mick. He's going to be part of that. Right?
Okay.
Everybody who has expressed interest in being part of that portion of it, you will receive information from Matt in Perth, Western Australia, and I've already sent your email along to him, so he will be sending emails out.
Okay. He will send out instructions.
Those of you who would be interested in just like going onto the Hangout in terms of a chat, I'm still investigating that and make sure I know how that works. But we may be able to have those of you who want to just join into the chat rooms and make comments about things that Mick or Mike or Tony or whoever, you know, is participating, things that they say, you can pop up on the side with a comment.
Okay.
Or a question for them. So that's something to, by next week's episode, I should be able to give everybody all the information they need for that.
Okay. And what time is it on the February 8th again?
It's going to be 7:30 a.m. our time.
Which is mountain
time.
Time in the U.S. 7:30?
Excuse me. 7:30.
Okay. Maybe we should make up a chart as to what time it will be everywhere else.
Just maybe. Fun. But you can already just look that up online. So.
I know, but...
Just for fun?
I don't know. Just like, look what time zones Aquarimax is reaching right now. I don't know.
Maybe we could do that, yeah.
Okay, so... Thank you, Mick.
Mm-hmm.
And let's go to Mike in Savannah. He says, I have a question to contribute. Salt for freshwater fish is a pretty common additive to prevent or help cure ailment in fish. There is aquarium salt specifically meant for freshwater fish. However, I have lots of marine aquarium salt, reef crystals, readily available. Is it okay to use marine salt interchangeably for freshwater salt?
Okay, well... It does depend on your purpose, and as we talk about the other questions, we will go into that. But in some cases, yes. In other cases, not really.
Okay, so should we just continue with the other questions, and that will elaborate on?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. His next question is it better for the fish because of the added minerals?
Well, if you're setting up a brackish tank, definitely.
Wait. Is marine salt better because of added minerals?
Yes.
Okay.
That's what he's talking about.
Okay.
Marine salt does contain carbonate buffers and so on, and those are good if you're setting up tanks, say, with mollies or guppies or certain puffer fish or different things like that.
A brackish tank.
A brackish tank, like what I use for the opaiula, that's what I use. It helps buffer the water, keeps pH stable and high, and those types of fish are happy that way.
Okay, and if you're not sitting up
if you're not, and you have fish that are intolerant to high pHs, then no. You're not setting up a brackish tank, but you're doing something like treating a specific situation, then I wouldn't use it. Because the pH change could be shocking for them.
You wouldn't use the marine, you would use freshwater.
I would use freshwater salt, yeah, in those cases. But if you're setting up a tank where you want the... This is the kind of water I'm using in this tank, even gradually, then I would use the marine salt.
Okay. He says, is the marine salt worse for the fish because of the additional buffering capacity of the salt?
And that is the case if the fish are sensitive to it. And especially, you know, pH swings can be bad. So if you have fish that are in water, say, like 6.3... and you put in some marine salt, it's going to make the, depending on how much you put in, but it'll make the pH shoot up, maybe to 8 or something. Because the buffers in salt water at the concentrations of salt water buffer the pH in the, like 8.1, 8.2, somewhere in there. So it might not get quite that high, but it would shoot up a lot and it would be bad.
Okay.
For those fish.
And then he asks, what about table salt? That's iodized. Can this be used? And he says, I've heard it both ways.
You know, I've heard it both ways too. I have tended to avoid it. And partly because of the iodine. the fact that it's iodized may or may not be an issue. I've heard some people say that quantity of iodine won't really hurt the fish, and that may or may not be the case. But all the anti-caking agents in there and other things, I don't know what those would do, so I'd rather avoid it.
That makes sense.
But you can just pick up like rock salt for use making ice cream and use that.
I guess it wouldn't be iodized, huh?
No, it's not. And it doesn't have anti-caking agents in it either.
Mm. Would you crush it up or would you just...
It depends. You want it to dissolve thoroughly before you start using it. But you know, I've walked into a lot of pet stores and they get water softener salt. And they put a couple of the chunks, they almost look like charcoal briquettes except for smaller, but that kind of shape, a pillow shape.
Mm-hmm.
And they just put two or three of those in a cup and drop the cup into the tank and let them slowly dissolve. And I'm not advocating that, but I've seen it done. A lot of pet stores will do that.
Okay. So, like you said, it kind of depends on what you're using it for.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He says, lastly, would you even recommend use of salt in freshwater aquaria and under what circumstances?
Well, it used to be more important because there used to be a lot of issues, and I guess sometimes there still are, but in general, if... With good husbandry practices, you can avoid things like nitrite toxicity, which salt is good for reducing. You know, it reduces the effects of nitrite toxicity. But if you don't have cycling issues, your tank has a nice, robust cycle, and you know the bacteria are happy, and you don't have to worry about that, then why use it for that, right?
Right. Well, you could still use it. Does he mean other than just if the fish are sick?
I think he's asking, well, when would you use it as a treatment for the fish? And it can be used as a treatment for fungal infections.
Yeah.
And for certain bacterial infections.
Isn't it good for ick?
It can be used to treat ick. I didn't discover that.
Oh, come on.
But people have used that. No, no, really.
I'm teasing.
Okay. But the... people have used it to treat ick. I've used it to treat ick. It's been a while since I've used it to do that, but you can... And various other things. If your fish has an osmoregulatory issue, like...
Say that again.
An osmoregulatory issue?
That's just too fun.
Okay. Like, it's got... it's absorbing too much water, usually, is the issue, right? You can use salt to help it...
Balance out?
Yeah, sort of draws some of the fluids out of its tissues, and that can help. Now... We talked a little bit more about that in depth on episode 186. And Wet Web Media has a cool little article written up on that.
About salt?
About both types of salt. About sodium chloride salt and about Epsom salts.
You can use Epsom salts?
For fish, yeah. It actually helps with fish constipation, strangely enough.
Oh.
It's used for people that way, too, but... Can be used for fish. So when to use which one and when you shouldn't use to which one is kind of something we discussed in some depth in that episode, 186. And if I would recommend reading that article on Wet Web Media about it. They have some good stuff there. So hopefully that helps.
Those are good questions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're going to go to Chris in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And he says, in my last email, I was thinking about moving turquoise rainbows into a 75-gallon tank. I wound up with just placing one male and female yellow rainbows along with 10 Schwartzy Cory cats. On an aquarium equipment note, I have made the switch to using separate thermostat units for my heaters. No, not cheap for changing a number of tanks, but peace of mind is worth it. FYI, I bought the Phoenix Digital 300-watt capable version. So, I am not the person who understands all the technical gadgety stuff. Because that is its real name, technical gadgety stuff.
Okay.
Okay, so what does that mean, separate thermostat units for his heaters?
Okay. If you go to the pet store and you buy a heater,
mm-hmm.
It's got a built-in thermostat.
Right.
So, the whole little unit encased in that tube... has a heating coil, and it has a thermostat, which is usually a couple of strips of metal hooked up so that they bend at different temperatures, and so one bends this way when it gets warmer, and one bends the other way when it gets cooler. This strip, they're usually together, and so they pull
they
push
pull
depending
each other
on
back
the temperature.
And
It either makes contact, completing the circuit, turning the thing on, and then when it warms up, it bends again and breaks the circuit and it starts to cool off, and then it clicks back on, clicks back off like that. That's
Okay.
basically the idea behind that type of thermostat that's in there. There are some disadvantages to it. And if you do what he has done here, you have the advantage of a higher quality thermostat. This is a digital, as it says, which may refer more to the readout than to the technology made to do it. But there tend to be a higher quality a higher quality thermostat, and you can put the probe further away from the heater, so you get more accurate temperature. Because if it's all encased in one thing, on the
It's
other
reading
side of
its
the
own
tank, it's
temperature,
reading the
right?
temperature right there, but on the other side of the tank, it might be several degrees cooler, conceivably, depending on water flow and the size of everything and all that stuff. So if you want the tank to be, more accurate, you can put the probe on a different part of the tank, and that will regulate the temperature by causing the heater to itself to turn on or off based on the temperature read by the probe. Does that make
Okay.
sense?
So basically, he's not using the thermostat that it came with. He bought a separate thermostat and hooked it up to the heater.
Right.
Okay. He says, I was wondering if Russ had any opinions on the usable life of fluorescent lights regarding par and ideal spectrum for a planted tank. 6 months seems to be thrown around often. Just curious.
Okay. Should I explain what par is?
Yes, because it's probably nothing to do with golf.
No, it's not. It stands for photosynthetically available radiation.
Is that what it stands for in golf?
I hope not.
I don't know. They're out in the sun. They can, maybe the golf course is photosynthesizing.
Well, some of the golf course is undoubtedly photosynthesizing,
Okay,
but the idea
wait. Say it one more time. Photosynthetic.
is photosynthetically available radiation.
Photosynthetically available radiation. There
Yes.
will be a quiz later, I'm sure.
There may be, I don't know.
Okay.
But the idea is that, all light bulbs produce light of one sort or another, right? But not all of that light is particularly useful to the plants.
Okay.
So measuring par is measuring how much of that light
Is
is actually
useful?
helping the plants photosynthesize.
Okay.
That's the idea. And of course, spectrum is something we've talked about
That's
too. That's
color of
important.
light and
And yeah,
right?
there's different areas. Yes, basically, color of light would be a basic way to say it. That's good. And we know that plants, freshwater plants, tend to do well close to 6,500, 6,700 K, and they can do well at other temperatures too. But that's usually a great one to do. They can. And it changes the color. That tends to be a little more on the yellowish side. You can go down to 2,800 K and get more of a purplish light, and plants can also do well there, but it looks funny to us. It looks rather dim and
Right.
purpley. You can go up higher, and if you go too much higher, it'll be like the marine spectrum, and it'll tend to encourage algae. But if you're getting up to like 12,000 K, 10,000 K, you're mimicking things that would happen in a marine situation. Good
Okay.
for growing photosynthetic organisms, corals and stuff that have symbiotic zooxanthellae in them, this sort of thing. But if the basic idea here that he's asking, though, is not so much that as much as how long is the usable life of the bulb, because things change over time, the spectrum shift, and the amount of light that's actually
The light
produced
bulb
that,
just doesn't work as well as when you first bought it.
yeah, and a fluorescent light bulb's a year after you buy it might look nearly as bright to us, but the photosynthetically available radiation is considerably reduced, like by 90%.
That's a lot.
Yeah. And he mentioned 6 months, and that is very commonly cited. And I've never done any like particular studies on it. All I can say is that I've purchased things like the power compact fluorescents, like the ones down there on that tank. They are supposed to last a year. It says to replace them after a year. A number of them
Specific,
are
it
like
says
that.
that specifically in relation to par.
No, it just says replace this bulb after a year because it's not going to be as useful.
Okay.
That's true of some of the T5s I've bought too, I think. And then the T8s, T12s, the more normal fluorescents, just the normal output fluorescents you think of, like the ones you hang on your ceiling and also on some of the older aquarium fixtures or more basic ones, they tend to say, I mean, I've seen some that say that they last 3 years, but I don't believe it. That may be for visible light for humans,
But
but
not for plant
not for the plant
useful
growth.
light.
I've noticed a difference after about 6 months. So I like to change those in 6 months, but the other ones seem to do fine for about a year. The ones, like the compact fluorescence and so on. So that's my rule of thumb. Pretty
Okay.
basic. I don't know a whole lot about it. That's just how I've run things and how anecdotally I can report on that it seems to work.
Alrighty. Here we go.
But you got to read that part because he says such a cool word.
Oh, he does say a cool word. He says, "Thank you for providing this spectacurific show and to the contributing listeners."
Thank you. And I would like to say sometimes our listeners say really cool things at the end, and it's fun to say them.
It is, they say fun things. It's true.
Yeah. Okay. So there you go.
Okay, oh, we have another one from Mick.
Yes, we do.
Okay, and he sent the video of the paradise fish that he was talking about before. So we'll put that up.
It's cool. I liked it.
In fact, he says the
Nice
glass
looking
fish will
tank.
be noted by their absence. Quite shy critter, so I think it will add a few more to see if that brings them out a bit.
It's a cool tank. You should see it.
I know I haven't seen the video yet. I'll see it.
Oh, do you hear that? Chirping gecko.
Oh, I did hear that. I don't know if the microphone's going to pick
I
it
don't
up.
know if it's going to pick it up either, but if
Sounds
you
like
heard it,
somebody
it was a
tapping on
chirping
the glass of
gecko.
the aquarium, actually. He says the tank is in the fish room, so it's running at about 25 degrees Celsius or 77 degrees Fahrenheit. Paradise fish are happy with that, and it allows the addition of the shark and glass fish.
Cool. I've heard so many different things about paradise fish and temperature, so I'm glad to hear that they're thriving for you and they look really good in that tank. And the tank looks really good too,
So
the way
is he
you
saying
set it
that's
up.
on the warmer side for the paradise fish?
It's on the, yeah,
Okay.
it sounds like that's what he's saying.
Because you were
The
saying
range
they
that I've
like
heard
cooler water.
that they, they live in temperate areas or close to temperate areas where it maybe doesn't get as cold as it does here, but the water gets down really cold, close to freezing or at freezing even.
Okay. He says, I was thinking of setting up a tub outside in the summer to put the paradise fish in and see if they will breed out there. What do you think? I would put a good layer of leaf litter at the bottom and have a good dose of plants too, and a good fitting mesh top.
Well, you know what? That sounds like a great idea. And I would like to bring this up too, that in the early days of Aquarimax, we had an interview on this very topic.
Wasn't that our first interview
If
with
it wasn't our
somebody?
first interview, it was one of our first interviews. And I'm trying to remember which episode it was. It was pretty far back there. And I think it might have been Brady up in Logan.
I remember it being kind of local, like either northern Utah or southern Idaho.
Hey, look at that. It's episode 46, and
Oh,
it's
okay.
Brady, Experience Breeding Paradise Fish in an Outdoor Container Pond.
Well, there you go.
So you can check out episode 46. He said it went like a charm. It worked really well. So
Yeah.
I would say, despite the differences in climate that we might encounter between here and Carnforth, and he's up in Logan, so that's even higher up in the mountains than we are. But it worked for him.
Yeah.
So I would say go for it.
And let us know how it goes,
Yeah,
'cause
I'm
that'd
sure
be
you'd
fun.
have some smashing success, and it would be fun to report on it, see your videos and whatnot of
Yeah.
your progress.
Okay, we're going to
In
Robert
Florida.
in Florida. He says, I bought my bulbs from Triangle Bulbs on eBay. They cost $12.99 for 12 bulbs delivered. He sells a lot of bulb types.
Yeah, we were talking
That's really
about
cheap.
bulbs and where to get them and all that kind of
Right.
stuff recently. Oh, wow.
He
I'm
says,
going to look that
I
up.
like 10K bulbs better, but I don't want to pay $12 each for them plus shipping.
Yeah, it's expensive.
But
And I would like to see.
that's really cheap, isn't it?
Yeah, it is really, really cheap. I'm going to look that
Especially
up.
including shipping. Holy
And I'm
cow.
not sure which what kind of bulbs is.
He
They're
doesn't say.
T5s. T5
Oh, is it
fluorescent bulb
T5?
force.
Okay.
Okay, wow. That's amazing. Had I known that, I had a fixture that I got rid of because I couldn't find T5 bulbs cheap enough to justify keeping
Yeah.
it. So,
We'll have to
darn.
look that guy up.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks for the tip, Robert.
Yeah. Triangle
Okay.
bulbs on eBay.
And we've got Tony in New York. He says, Russ, I remember you mentioning on a recent podcast that you suspected a guppy and a molly could produce offspring. I wanted you to know that the Pet Fish Talk guys, Tom and Nevin, agree with you. This was mentioned in one of their special shows entitled Guppies and Mollies, and it can be found here. And he put a link.
Which so we will put on the show notes. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to say that this is an intriguing idea. Not that I'm thinking of doing it, but just the fact that it could work is just an interesting idea to me. So I've been doing some research on it. And if you look at on the internet and you do a search for... I tried to do a scholarly search for scholarly papers on it, there isn't anything. Maybe that's because
hybridization is looked down upon?
Often. It's got all kinds of things about the types of mollies that, you know, almost hybridize with others, but they only have... The sperm don't actually contribute any genetic material to them, and so it just causes the eggs to start developing.
Interesting.
The Amazon mollies do that, you know, and things like that. It's got a whole bunch of stuff on that. Doesn't have... that. At least I didn't see any, and I can't say that there aren't any, but I didn't see any when I did that. But if you do a search, an image search for a guppy molly hybrid, you come up with quite a few things. Some of them which look fairly convincing. There's a guy who has videos of some of his, and another one who just has photos of fish that do not look like mollies or guppies, but they do look convincingly like something in between.
Weird.
So it seems to be happening.
You should put some of the pictures up for people to see, or put some of the
links up. Yeah, well, this link here that I'm going to put up has a photo.
Okay.
And it looks pretty convincing to me. It has characteristics of both guppies and mollies. Yeah, I'll show it to you. It's very interesting. You want to see right now? Here, I'll just pop it up. Well,
they can't see it right now unless they...
I know, but you can see it, and then you can make all sorts of lovely comments about it.
Oh, yeah, because I make lovely comments.
See, look at that.
That looks like something else.
Doesn't it? I mean, if you look at the dorsal fin...
It looks
fin,
like a different fish, though.
And you look at the face, you can almost see a guppy there, but then it's too heavy-bodied, deep-bodied for a guppy. But the coloration certainly looks guppy-esque,
but
not
quite
guppy-ish.
Looks like he has a beaky
nose. Yeah. Yeah, it's a very interesting fish.
Weird.
I don't know. I can't be certain that that's what that is, but it's certainly not a Photoshopped picture. I mean, that's a real fish.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some Photoshopped pictures out there, what appear to be Photoshopped pictures of... so-called guppy molly hybrids, or gollies or muppies or whatever they call them.
Maybe they're fish Bigfoot.
Yeah, but that one looks pretty convincing, and I've seen others that look very similar, that where people profess to have guppy molly hybrids, so I kind of...
Interesting.
And they seem to be coming out all males.
Where are they? Oh, sorry. Sorry, excuse me. Are they sterile?
Would
they then... breed with other guppies or other mollies?
One person says that they have F2 hybrids, meaning that they took fish like that and got offspring from them.
But they're all coming out male?
But most of them do seem to be coming out male, so either in that case some didn't come out male, or those were breeding with something else. I don't know what's going on, but it's interesting. And so thank you, Tony. I'll have to check out that episode again. I don't think I've listened to that in years. And hopefully everyone will check out those pictures.
Yeah, and he has another note here, too. South Shore, Boston, Bob.
Mm-hmm.
He says, also, welcome aboard, Bob, from the South Shore of Boston. Did you, or was it Dr. Bob, appear in Aquarimax episode 113? In that episode, there was a discussion of mollies who seemed to worship an aquarium heater. Oh, I remember that. That was funny.
Mm-hmm.
That discussion was prompted by one Bob from Boston. If it wasn't one of you, I wonder what shore Bob from 113 is from.
And you know, I looked back. It is South Shore Bob.
Oh, it is?
Mm-hmm. I checked my notes on episode 113, which are on this iPad, and I did a search, you know,
and found it.
So,
do you still have those mollies? That was probably kind of a while ago. I don't know
if he has the same mollies.
Do they still like the heater?
Mm-hmm.
You should let us know. That would be really funny.
Well, it's kind of a blast from the past, huh?
Yeah. Okay. I think that's everybody from today.
Is it? Okay.
Do we have anything else that we need to discuss?
I don't think so.
Before we send everybody on their merry fishy way?
Let's do that. I think we're just about there. We'll let you know more about the Google Hangout as it comes along. Gets closer.
In the meantime,
may the fish
be with you.